Wake up, y'all.
From Jerusalem, Israel, this is From the Midwest to the Middle East, the podcast that explores everything new in U.S. and Israeli economy. Here's your host, Philip Stein.
Whether you're young, whether you're old, whether you have a lot of money, whether you don't have much at all, it's always good to know how to invest in the stock market. And we have a very interesting, very experienced, very well-known guest today, namely Aaron Katzman, who will be joining me to talk about the markets, how to invest, what not to invest in. I think you'll enjoy
this episode. Is brought to you by Philip Stein and Associates, the largest U.S. CPA firm in Israel, providing U.S. tax services to Israelis, Americans, corporations, startups, and anyone else needing them.
Well, today I'm excited to have a colleague, someone I've known for many years, and to talk about a very interesting subject that I think is on everyone's mind in terms of their investment portfolio. Today, my guest is Aaron Katzman, who is also, I think, Aaron, you and I go back to the days of Radio West, if you remember that.
Huh? I certainly remember that. Wow. That's a lot. So you pulled that out of the hat.
That's really way back. Now, remember, some of our older lists, about Teak listeners, will know what I'm talking about. Anyway, Aaron's the president of Lighthouse Capital, which is a boutique wealth management firm in Jerusalem. He's a licensed financial professional both in Israel and the U.S. Aaron has nearly 30 years of experience helping people open and manage their investment accounts in the U.S. He has a weekly personal finance column, if anyone who reads the Friday Post will see it, a podcast, and has even been on CNBC. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks so much for having me, giving me the opportunity.
It's good to see you, and always good to talk to you. So let's begin. And again, I'm speaking here as a layman and reflecting the many things I've heard from clients over the last year. They feel, and I think they're correct, that the world seems to be in turmoil, be it the war in the Ukraine, the ineffectiveness of Congress, major increases in interest rates, and of course, right here at home, Israel's current conflict. Nonetheless, the U.S. stock market is hitting record highs. Is there any correlation between world economic events and how the markets perform?
That's a really good question. I think that you're getting that question a lot. I think I get that question all the time.
Okay.
From clients and prospective clients. The short answer, I think, is in the very, very short term, there can be market gyrations as a response to turmoil and some of the issues and other issues like this, big issues that happen. But over the long term, it's virtually irrelevant. It's like a blip, uh-huh. a blip on the screen. If you ever look at a long term chart of the stock market in general, the S&P 500 in particular, they're historical aberrations almost, right? In the last couple of years, we've had all the issues that you mentioned. We had Corona. In 2022, the stock market dropped significantly. Mm-hmm. 2008, we had a financial crisis. 2000, the high-tech industry blew up. And, over time, the economy just keeps growing. And as such, corporate earnings are good and stock markets keep going higher. Now, I would say the one issue that you mentioned of the interest rates, we'll probably get into it a little bit later also, that's the one issue which is a little bit more fundamental and can have longer lasting consequences for the markets. Mm-hmm. But again, the markets like to look ahead. And as soon as there's a whiff of good news or pausing the hike in interest rates or even cutting interest rates, generally, the markets are going to go off, are going to head for the races. And that's exactly what happened this time.
It's just very interesting. So what is the old saying? Sell on the news. What is it? I forget. What was that?
Buy the news and buy the rumor, sell the fact.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of that.
So if I go back a little more than a year, literally just a little more than a year, at the end of 2022, almost every financial expert was predicting a recession in 2023 in the U.S. And yet they all ended up, it seems, being wrong. Maybe there were a few outliers. What happened there?
So There's a term that's sort of becoming popular, and it's being called American or U.S. exceptionalism, as
Okay.
opposed to the rest of the world, right? The rest of the world economically is sort of up the creek. If you look at Europe and China and rest of Asia, I'll leave Israel out because they're extenuating circumstances right now in Israel. But the U.S. is just, all the naysayers at the beginning, all the pundits at the beginning of 2022 predicted for the markets to get crushed, right? Because of the recession, the higher interest rates were going to take their toll in order to get down inflation. And the re end result would be, horrific corporate earnings and then a bad stock market to boot. And what happened was just the opposite. The American economy just keeps chugging along, right? Leaving politics aside, the growth is very, very strong. Unemployment is at record levels. Record lows. And corporate earnings, again, you might have to distinguish between different sectors in the economy, but overall earnings are very, very strong, especially like in the tech sector. They're off the charts. I mean, they're printing money.
Yeah, I heard something that that Meta, for AKA Facebook, went up, I think, in, I don't know, in one day or some, the value of the company went up some crazy amount, or certainly they were talking about how much Zuckerberg's personal wealth went
Right.
up, but just crazy.
20%. It went up like 20 for 22 to something like that in the day. And that was because their earnings, which were, the bar was super high. Everybody's expecting really good earnings, and they were above and beyond anything that anybody expected. And the stock just, rocked after that. And that's been the story of the market. It's really been a story of super strong earnings that's the product ultimately of a much stronger economy than anybody dreamed we were going to be seeing at this point of this economic cycle. That's for sure.
So I recently saw a table showing the best performing stocks in the S&P 500 over the last 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. And of course, what really jumped out at me was that a stock like a Apple went up, and I kept looking at this. Maybe I was reading it right, maybe it was printed right, went up 54,910% over the last 20 years. I remember my parents' stockbroker advising him to buy individual stocks. Over it today, today it seems the conventional wisdom is to invest in indexes or mutual funds. And is investing in individual stocks, quote unquote, old school?
So I think that's a great question. The reason I think that the move towards index, there's a reason that people have moved towards indexing, and that's that statistically, it turns out it's a better way to make money. The question is maybe why that's the case, right? When your parents were getting pitched stocks by their stockbroker, there wasn't an internet, there wasn't 24/7 financial cable news.
That's true.
There was no way to disseminate information, right? So the stockbroker worked at Morgan Stanley, and he got, fresh off the press, the analysts, the researchers,
I think it was E.F. Hutton.
E.F. Hutton, right? So there, everybody listened when E.F. Hutton talked, right? So they would get hot off the press, the in-house research, which then was really good, right? They had insights and they met companies and they knew things that most people, there was just that information wasn't out
Inter
there.
in interesting.
And they were able to, if you just followed their predictions and their picks, you would do pretty well. Today, that doesn't exist, right? It's instantaneous, the
Interesting.
transfer of information. And statistically, it's just that, it's virtually impossible to find one of those. It's not virtually impossible, you can do it, but statistically it's very, very difficult, right? The top managers, the top money managers in the world, over 90% of them fail to beat their own specific benchmark. So if they're going to try and work in the world of the S&P 500, the biggest companies in America, the overwhelming majority of them are not going to do as well as the index. So the thought process is, well, why should I pay them more and get less, right? I can pay a lot less because, index investing is super cheap. And ultimately, I'm going to get better returns. And then it sort of turns into, I would say, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because everybody's indexing. Even the best stock pickers out there are swimming upstream, right? Because they could have the best like value proposition that exists. They could have, uncovered the gem,
Okay.
but everybody's just dumping their money into the indexes, so it doesn't make a difference. There's no way for to really capitalize on the diamond in the rough that they're finding. So, like I said, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more the money that goes into indexing, the easier it is to index, and the harder it is to actually pick specific stocks. The last year, all the headlines have been about, seven or eight stocks have carried the entire market, right?
Right,
Microsoft,
right.
and Meta, like you said, Facebook and Nvidia and what have you. That's not so unusual. I saw a number a couple of months ago that over the last 100 years or so, 7% of the stocks in the S&P 500 brought in like 80% or 90% of the returns, right? So now we're, that's 35 stocks or 40 stocks out of the 500. Now it's down to, over the last year, it's been eight that's carried it. But it's never been, all 500 stocks, which are, powering returns. It's always been sort of a select few. And again, in the old days, like I said, when the analysts sort of knew what was going on with all 500 stocks and they could come out with research, they could sort of cherry pick those 35 stocks, but and give you the returns. Today, it's just so much more difficult, right? We know after the fact, well, I should have put money in Apple, right? But from today going
Right.
forward, you tell me what the top seven stocks are going to be or the top 10 stocks
Right.
going forward. It's virtually impossible. So that's why. And I think rightfully so for most investors. Warren Buffett even said, for the average investor, the best thing they can do is stick their money into an index. Right? They have no
Period. Yeah.
business trying to compete against the big boys who have, extra information or what have you. They're not going to be successful over the long term. And the best way is just to index.
All right, that's very insightful. I think the term I most recently saw, now they're calling them the Magnificent Seven, right? That's the from the iconic movie.
It used
All
to be the
right,
Nifty 50,
right.
but that's how much it's come down, right? It used to be the Nifty 50, right? That was 10% of the index. So now we're at, seven stocks out of the 500, but it's always been like that. It's just it's a little more extreme today, I
No,
would say.
that. Yeah, I think now that I'm thinking back, my parents coming home from, they'd go to meet, they'd get dressed up, my dad would put on a tie and go down to meet the broker, and that's what they were called in those days. And I think, AT&T, they said just we want you to sleep at night, and I guess they got their dividend checks, and that was it. It was a very, you're right, very different times. Over the years, I've been very surprised to meet people in my practice, well into their careers, earning good salaries, and I know you've written about this, and yet they have no savings. Okay, have you found that Gen X, Gen Y don't understand the need to start saving at a young age?
I think that that's 100% that they don't. I don't know that, the baby boomers also were better. That I don't know, right? It might be that you get a little bit of kick in the pants when you hit middle age and life, reality sets in, and you realize you better start saving for retirement. But I think specifically with Gen X and Gen Y, and in today's situation of everything having to be instant, right? Everything's on the phone. It's you swipe something if you don't like it. There's no concept of staying power. There's no concept of, a little here and a little there add up over years and years and years to something huge. It's just not in the lexicon. It's not in their consciousness because everything is so instant today. That I think coupled with the fact that you don't even have to pull the plastic. Nothing is cash anymore, right? Even Israel's moving to a cashless society, which I think is horrific because it's just going to increase people's debt loads more and more and more. It's not even pl you don't even have to go to your wallet anymore and pull out plastic. You just you take your handheld device, you take your cell phone, and you pay for something now. So there's not even any. There's no, you do it sort of sort of subconsciously or unconsciously, you just pay. You don't think, you don't feel the money, right? It doesn't hurt you to take something out and pay for something because it's all
Interesting.
virtual.
Interesting.
And then, there's credit is galore, and you can get it, animals can get credit cards today, right? And everybody gets a credit card.
Right.
It's just so easy. And unless you have sort of a certain fortitude to stand up against it, you're going to succumb. And, taking on high debt loads is pretty simple. You see on TikTok videos, these reels on TikTok where people are saying, well, the only way to wealth is by taking on debt. I mean,
Really?
it's
Okay, I haven't.
preposterous. It's totally preposterous, but that's what's playing, and that's what's sort of, getting into the psyche of the youth. And obviously it's dangerous. I think the hope is that, again, right, life will take over, and they'll see the light at some point, because reality is going to set in, and they're going to realize that, while they're paying Visa every month, and Visa's doing great, right? Visa keeps coming out with record earnings,
Right.
but their bank accounts aren't getting any bigger, let alone their savings. I think it's a big issue. It's something I think it has to start earlier on. I think there has to be a lot of education in the schools to teach proper financial habits, because people aren't getting it at home, right? A lot of people are just seeing their parents do the same thing, right? They think, I mean, I've written about this. When my kids were little, they think that money comes out of a wall, right? You just, you type in four numbers, you put a card in the wall, you type in four numbers, and out comes the money. Well, that's magic, right? They don't understand that you have to work hard, and then you save and all these different things. And without sort of proper education, it's going to be an issue.
No, I've seen it in my practice, and it's very interesting what you say about the cashless society. I mean, again, yes, I have my I rarely pull out my wallet anymore. I just take my phone and it's very convenient. But someone I know, whose son was in the restaurant business, and he told me, and unfortunately, he had to close it recently, that in a previous, maybe 10 years ago, something like 80% of his turnover was cash, and today it's 10, maybe 10%. In other words, people that come in with their watches, their phones. There's no cash anymore. So I guess it's probably for governments, it's a good thing. Okay, less opportunities not to pay taxes, but
I'll tell you, I'm on the board, and I volunteer for an organization which helps get people out of debt. And it's horrific, right? The move to non-cash is not going to do people in debt. It's not going to be a big help for them to try and get out of debt.
got it.
There's something magical about, actually taking out a bill from your wallet, especially when you don't have much money left in the bank that month. Right. And you choose your spending decisions wisely. And when you don't have that, and you just, you pay on your watch, like you said, you have no concept, right? You can't, it's very easy to lose control very quickly. You're right. Just, it might be great for governments to try and counter or track the black market, so to
Sure,
speak, but it's
sure.
not going to do their citizens any good.
Interesting. Wow. All right, so as I'll speak as a representative of my generation, the baby boomers. What financial mistakes do you find that my generation makes
That's a good
tend to
question. I
make?
think that your generations are totally across the board. I think that most, a lot of your generation, the people that I deal with in your generation, put it this
Right,
way, have
right.
made smart financial decisions. They've saved, they own their homes, they've helped put their kids through school, right? They've done everything, I think, by the book.
Right.
They might not have started out with what you can say, right? Did you start out that way, or did you sort of gravitate towards that? But then there's the other side of it, where I think they still haven't grown up. And there's a certain concept out there, that the government is going to take care of them, right? The government, I'll get my Social Security, or I'll get my
Right.
Bituach Lumi, right?
Right.
And the government, they look to the government to solve all their problems anyway. And this is just another one. Okay, so I've saved, the average American, I think, in their 50s, have saved $50,000 towards retirement. I mean, that's just not going to get the job done,
No, it is
right?
not.
It's not going to happen, right? Throw in a couple thousand dollars a month of Social Security, and you might get by, but you're certainly not going to have the kind of retirement that you dreamed of, and you're probably going to be
Correct.
working well into your well into that retirement. And ultimately, until they get the wake-up call that what they're going to get from the government is just not enough. They're going to have to at some point face reality, and unfortunately, too many of them, again, it's the same thing almost that's the Gen Xers and the Gen Yers have fallen into, right? Easy credit, debt is not bad, you'll deal with it later. They've fallen into the same trap. And then they say, well, the government will bail me out. But at the end of the day, the government's not going to bail them out. Hopefully, Social Security will even be around when they come to take it. But the financial mismanagement is it's shocking, right? It's really
No,
shocking.
it's interesting, and this is not, we're not going to talk, that could be a whole different podcast, about Aliyah from the United States and the predictions that are being thrown out there. But when I see a lot of people, in my age category, they've used their home as a piggy bank, as they like to say. So they don't have that much equity. They haven't saved that much. Yes, they have a Social Security, they may have IRA. But to enter into the Israeli real estate market, it's a real hard transition unless they've, had an exit or had an inheritance. It's really
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that's something I've seen more and more that people were thinking about making Aliyah. I know this is a little bit of a sidetrack, but they should focus on A, building equity in their home, and B, I think saving in a taxable way as well, not dumping everything to the IRA. I've had people come to me who want to come in and want to come to Israel and buy a home. So, well, I've got, they've got a significant, they actually did it right. They put all their money into the IRA. They've got a lot of money in the IRA. They don't realize that when if they take out $500,000 from the IRA, that they're going to lose $170,000 of it to the IRS. They don't
Correct.
understand the tax consequences of how expensive that money is to withdraw in big chunks. And that's even the people who did it right are up the creek. But the people that you're talking about, for sure, they're basically going to be renting when they move to Israel. They're not going to be able to enter the property market.
Just as we're getting toward the end, and I think this is something you are particularly expert to speak about. How does someone who lives in Israel, particularly a U.S. citizen, who still has most of their savings in dollars, which are invested in U.S. financial markets, keep up with local inflation and local currency swings? What's your
It's a great question. It's probably the number one question. The first thing that I would say is if your money's invested, I haven't done this. This is not statistical, what I'm going to say, but it's something that I've sort of tracked over decades into the business. Ultimately, your investments are going to do significantly more than any kinds of swings in the currency. That's number one. I think that's really important. You're not going to be able to, if most of your funds are in the US, you're not going to be able to save, invest locally because it's very, very difficult, right? You can maybe speak to it. There are all these different things, right? There's what's called a PFIC. It's prohibitively challenging to invest locally for an American citizen.
That
It
is
can be
true.
done, but you're going to get nailed tax-wise. So, you could have a more global diversification in your portfolio because a lot of the times it's not just the dollar versus the shekel, but it's the dollar in the world versus other currencies. So if you have exposure to, you can all do it in dollars, but if you have exposure through your dollars to euros and to yen, you can go a long way into hedging your portfolio. That's number one. Number two, I'm not opposed. I think it's a good idea to bring some money over here. And you can put it into even a time deposit, whatever it is, just to start building up sort of your more liquid shekel base to, yes, hedge against the currency. You're not gonna, like I said, you're not gonna be able to fully hedge, but it's not a bad way. And for those people who are still working, they're putting money into their Keren Hishtalmut and they've got their pension,
Right.
they've got their home. So for them, it's much less an issue, right? Anyway, they're gonna want to diversify. So their long-term investments can be in the US because of the PFIC issues and whatever.
Right.
And their shekel, they're living in shekels, they're earning in shekels, everything else is in shekel anyway. So they've sort of de facto diversified. But the one thing I would, like I started off with, I wouldn't, I don't think that one, needs to do somersaults and get super, super creative until in terms of hedging. Because even in the years where, it's going to even out. And if the shekel moves up 10% a year, and the next year it'll be 2%, then it'll drop 3%, your investments are going to probably far, far exceed that over time. And it's a hit, but it's not such a big, big hit.
Okay. So I know this is recorded. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to end up just where I started. What's your outlook for 224? 2024.
So I tend to be an optimist generally. I don't know what's going to happen from today to tomorrow, but at some point in the US, the Federal Reserve is going to be cutting interest rates. Maybe not as much as people thought,
Okay.
maybe more than people thought. We don't know. But that's going to happen. And, historically, that's been a bonanza. When that process starts happening, that has been very, very, very good for the stock markets. And it's going to go a little bit against what I said before, right? Where we've seen very, very narrow, the Magnificent Seven.
Right.
It's going to help, I think, broaden the stock market rally to different sectors and different size companies, which haven't really participated as the Magnificent Seven have rocked and rolled over the last year, like smaller companies. They're going to be the real, real beneficiaries of, of lower interest rates because it's lower cost of capital for them to finance their businesses. And that's going to be a really, really big boom. The other thing I'd like to point out in terms of Israel, which has been in the news because of the downgrade of Israel's credit by Moody's,
Right,
I
right.
am very bullish, especially in the second part of the year on Israel. I think
Wow.
people, that's not exactly what I do, but I think that Israel is going to be unbelievable investment destination the second half of this year and the beginning of 2025. There's huge pent-up demand in consumers. There's a lot of money from consumers sitting on the sidelines. You have all these reservists who are slowly trickling coming back into the workforce. There's gonna be a lot of money. A lot of people haven't taken vacations. There's gonna be the foreigners
Wow.
haven't really come in. No airlines coming in. The real estate market has been frozen. I think things here are gonna be a lot better than anybody thinks. And if you're,
All right,
we
I
go
like
back, you want
that.
to come full circle. You said, right? You want to buy the room. Buy low and sell high. Another one of those adages. People who get into Israel now, I think, are buying low, and I think they're going to be richly rewarded.
All right, fantastic. All right, Aaron, thank you so much for this. Really interesting, insightful. If my listeners want to know more about you and your and Lighthouse Capital, how can they reach out to you?
Sure, they can find me at Aaron Katzman, AaronKatzman.com. They can find me on Facebook. I've got a YouTube channel. I write in the post. It's not too hard
To
to get a
find
hold of
you.
me.
Okay.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I really
All
appreciate
right.
it. It was a lot
All
of
right,
fun.
my pleasure. Be well. See you
Take
soon.
care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed our podcast. Feel free to visit us at www.pstein.com or look for Philip Stein and Associates on Facebook and LinkedIn.